We're still in the book of Deuteronomy, in the ninth chapter. The last time we'd gotten down through the 14th verse of the ninth chapter. In this ninth chapter, the main theme is Moses is reminding the people of their past disobedience to God. And the prime example that he is dealing with here is the time when they had shortly come out of Egypt and gotten to Mount Sinai, and he'd gone up into Mount Sinai to receive the Ten Commandments from God. And as you know, this was a very holy and solemn and awesome occasion. The whole mountain was filled with a smoke. The voice of God was heard by the people. And then after he had spoken to them, Moses went up on the mount and received the two tables of the testimony. And then as he was coming back down, after he'd received the Ten Commandments, and after he'd fasted 40 days and 40 nights, as he was coming back down, they discovered that the people then had sinned. They had built a golden calf and really turned against God to that extent. And Aaron was the one who built the calf for them. And so Moses is reminding them of the very serious nature of that sin and how that was just characteristic of their stubbornness, their stiff-neckedness, their disobedience to God, and how that they'd always been disobedient to God. So let me begin with the 11th verse, and we'll just read down to the 15th verse, and that's where we'll begin our lesson. And it came to pass at the end of 40 days and 40 nights, that the Lord gave me the two tables of stone, even the tables of the covenant. And the Lord said unto me, Arise, get thee down quickly from hence, for thy people, which thou hast brought forth out of Egypt, have corrupted themselves. They are quickly turned aside out of the way which I commanded them. They have made them a molten image. Furthermore, the Lord spake unto me, saying, I have seen this people, and behold, it is a stiff-necked people. Let me alone, that I may destroy them, and blot out their name from under heaven, and I will make of thee a nation mightier and greater than they. So we see the setting now. The Lord is so intensely upset with his people that he wants to completely blot them out. He wants there to even be no more record left of them. Start over fresh, anew, with Moses, and build another nation, another people, entirely different and separate from this disobedient people. Verse 15. So I turned and came down from the mount, and the mount burned with fire, and the two tables of the covenant were in my two hands. Now here he was carrying these two tables of stone, he says, in the two hands. And it's difficult for us to know how big they were, how heavy they were, because that's really not given, but he does say that it was in two hands, so apparently it was a pretty good load for him, requiring two hands to carry. And I looked, and behold, ye had sinned against the Lord your God, and had made you a molten calf. You had turned aside quickly out of the way which the Lord had commanded you. Now, Moses had been up here for 40 days and 40 nights, but he described this as having turned aside quickly out of the way. This was in the eyes of Moses a very quick turn from God. He couldn't even be gone 40 days without them having turned to another source of something to worship. And I took the two tables and cast them out of my two hands, and break them before your eyes. And Moses was so disappointed, or we might even say so disgusted, so heartsick. Here he'd gone through all of this experience with God and received these two tables of the testimony, the great Ten Commandments, and just as he'd gotten them and gotten all ready to implement the things pertaining to them, he comes down and they've turned to serve a molten calf. And so he in this heartsick and disgusted time, he cast them down and break them before your eyes. Now remember, these two tables of stone, they contained the testimony. They contain the covenant. They are the tables of the covenant. This is the agreement that God made with his people. This contained the agreement. These are the things that bound them to God. And so whenever they were broken by the great disobedience of the people, Then Moses completed the break by breaking the tables themselves, so that symbolically, figuratively, and literally, the covenant was broken. There was no more agreement between God and his people. They had so transgressed until they had nullified their part of the agreement. And so the tables were broken, no more use for them. And sometimes we think that God is just always there standing and always ready, and we can be so disobedient, we can be so flagrantly sinful, we can forget about him, we can do and think and anything we want to. Then if we ever decide we want to turn to God, all we have to do is just turn. He's always right there. But we must realize that the more we repel and sin against God, the harder it is for us to actually truly repent, because we have to harden ourselves to do this. And it can occur with us as it did with his people. The covenant broken. God's no longer obligated to live up to his part of the covenant, since we have so flagrantly violated our part of it. No covenant. Now, there was no covenant. God had already said that he wanted to wipe his people out from the face of the earth. He wanted to blot them out. He wanted to start over with a different people. And I fell down before the Lord, as at the first, 40 days and 40 nights. Now, here we see that Moses has just gone through this 40 day and 40 night fast. There's some question in the minds of the Bible scholars whether or not he goes through another 40 day and 40 night fast, but the way it reads to me here, he did. He did as at the first. He had another fast here. 40 days and 40 nights, I did neither eat bread nor drink water because of all your sins which you sinned in doing wickedly in the sight of the Lord to provoke him to anger. Now, we're going to see on this occasion where Moses was really and truly a faithful mediator between this people and God. Here was a chance for Moses to, even though he was so disgusted, even though he was so displeased, a good chance for Moses to say, God, they're not worthy of anything. You're right. Just absolutely wipe them out. This people is not fit for anything. But Moses didn't do that. He went through another fast. He didn't eat bread nor drink water because of the sin, which had sinned and doing wickedly in the sight of God, provoking anger. For I was afraid of the anger and hot displeasure wherewith the Lord was wroth against you to destroy you. Now that's, Moses was really afraid that God was going to do this. It put the fear into Moses. Moses was a believer that God was going to do this. Now remember, we've talked before how that the only record we have of God ever becoming anger, having anger and wrath, is when somebody turns from God to idolatry. But the Lord hearkened unto me at that time also. Now here's a time whenever Moses really stood up for the people. He made a plea for the people, and the Lord hearkened to his plea. And the Lord was very angry with Aaron to have destroyed him. And I prayed for Aaron also the same time. Moses had no malice in his heart for these people. He had no hatred or jealousy or strife toward them, really. He interceded on the part of God for them. God was ready to completely annihilate them. And I took your sin, the calf which you had made, and burnt it with fire, and stamped it, and ground it very small, even until it was as small as dust, and I cast the dust thereof into the brook that descended out of the mount. So that when this people would drink of the water of the brook, they would then be drinking the dust that had been, the ground up ashes of this calf. So we can see then the very distasteful scene and situation that Moses found himself in, and the people found themselves in. And there are other details of this given in other parts, but we're just going to stay with the narrative as he records it here in Deuteronomy 9. Now, in verse 22, he records some other times of disobedience. He's not through talking about what happened at Mount Sinai, but he records some other times of disobedience now in verse 22. And at Taberah. Now this situation of Taberah is found in Numbers 11 beginning with verse 3. And it's a time when the people murmured against God, and they wanted flesh, and he gave them quail, and but they were continuing to murmur. So God had a fire to come among the camp, and it consumed a lot of the people in the camp. This fire destroyed them. And they call this place Taberah because of that fire. Then he records another time, and at Massah, he says. And Massah is recorded in Exodus 17, 1 through 8. It's the time in which they were needing water, and the people murmured and chided Moses because they needed this water. And Moses did strike the rock, and they did get the water, but they tempted God here at this place. And it's a place in Rephidim where the water came from the smitten rock. It's also called Meribah. But he reminds him of that place, and this means the temptation. And then he says, and at Kibroth Hattaavah. Now, this Kibroth Hattaavah was the place where the people who were burned at Taberah, it's the place where they were buried. Their graves were there. It was located, according to Numbers 10:33, about 3 days from Sinai, about a 3 days journey from Sinai. Here was this burying ground, this Kibroth Hattaavah, and the account of that's found in Numbers 11, verse 33. So he names three serious reminders of their disobedience to God. And then he names another in verse 23, likewise when the Lord sent you from Kadesh Barnea, saying, go up and possess the land which I've given you. Then you rebelled against the commandment of the Lord your God, and you believed him not, nor hearkened to his voice. And so he reminds me of even another time about 2 years later in which they got up to Kadesh Barnea, and God said, now is the time to go in and take the land. They sent the spies over to spy the land out, and 10 of the spies came back, as you know, and said, oh, we can't take the land, and only two, Caleb and Joshua, said that we can't take the land, and the people just balked and refused to go in. So then that's when God said, okay, I'm going to strew your carcasses in this great wilderness and be 40 years here before you can get out. And it truly it was. But you see, it was time after time after time that the people rebelled against God. This is not all the times of rebellion. He just names four here in addition to, four reminders in addition to their making of the golden calf on Sinai. And what Moses is doing in this chapter, he is showing the people that they have utterly been a stiff-necked and rebellious people against God. And he cites examples for them to know about. So he says in verse 24, ye have been rebellious against the Lord from the day that I knew you. Now that's a pretty all-sweeping statement, because Moses has known his people for a long time. And he says, you've been rebellious against the Lord from the day that I knew you. Showing that they had always had this problem of rebelling against God. It is a part of human nature, it seems, to be rebellious against God and against authority. It's just a part of our being. And certainly this people was no different. And as he said in the beginning of this chapter, I'm not sending you into Canaan to run these other people out because of your goodness. They're being taken out because of their badness. You've been a stiff-necked people. So he resumes the narrative in verse 25. Thus I fell down before the Lord 40 days and 40 nights, as I fell down at the first, because the Lord had said he would destroy you. So he again recounts his fasting. I fell down 40 days and 40 nights, like I did at the first, because the Lord said he would destroy you. I prayed therefore unto the Lord and said, O Lord God, destroy not thy people and thine inheritance, which thou hast redeemed through thy greatness, which thou hast brought forth out of Egypt with a mighty hand. So Moses is interceding here on the part of this people. He's begging God. He's pleading for this people. Do not destroy this people. Notice what he calls them. He says, destroy not thy people and thine inheritance. These are the ones that are to inherit Your estate. These are thine inheritance, which thou hast redeemed through thy greatness, which thou brought forth out of Egypt with a mighty hand. Just remember, God, these are the people you brought forth out of Egypt with all of your greatness and your mighty hand. These are thy people. These are thine inheritance. He further says, remember thy servants, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Look not unto the stubbornness of this people, nor to their wickedness, nor to their sin. Now, Moses is making a big request here of God. He's telling God to overlook something. He said, do not look to the stubbornness of this people, nor to their wickedness, nor to their sin. God, just look the other way. Do not look at this. Now, you know, that'd be asking a lot of God, because God is all-seeing and all-knowing. God has a government that requires and demands that justice be done. And you can't just overlook a sin and say justice has been done. If a person commits a heinous crime in our society and the law just overlooks it, says, well, we know you did this. It sure was a bad thing for you to have done it, but we're just going to kind of forget about it now. Well, all kinds of cries would be given forth where justice wasn't done. And so it is with God. And so I can't believe that God completely just didn't look at their sin or their stubbornness or their wickedness. But he worked out some kind of a way where they could continue to serve him and not be destroyed. Moses says not to look at their stubbornness and wickedness and sin, lest the land whence thou brought us out, that would be Egypt, and he calls it the land, he's talking about the people in Egypt, lest the land which thou brought us out say, because the Lord was not able to bring them into the land which he promised them, and because he hated them, he hath brought them out to slay them in the wilderness. So this is another argument that Moses uses in appealing to God for this people. He says, the people over in Egypt are going to say that you hated them, and you brought them out here so that you could destroy them, and you weren't able to bring them into the land that you'd promised them. He's using all kinds of approaches here to get God to be just a little bit lenient and not to abolish and annihilate this people because of their sin with the golden calf. Yet they are thy people and thine inheritance. Regardless of what anybody says and regardless of what you do, they still are your people. They still are your inheritance, which thou broughtest out by thy mighty power and by thy stretched out arm. And we can see here where Moses is appealing to God on the same basis as somebody would appeal to a parent regarding a child. Regardless of what this child has done, regardless of how this child is hurt or turned against you, he's still your child. He's still your inheritance. He's still the one that you have protected all these years. And so that's Moses appealing to this part of God about this people. And so as we know then, God did relent, and he did not go through with his initial desire to blot this people from off the face of the earth and start over with a new people with Moses. So as we go into the 10th chapter of Deuteronomy, this chapter describes then the things that God did after Moses made this great appeal. We see that God did definitely give this people every chance. He just seemed to go overboard now to benefit and bless this people. Now let's notice some of the great things that he did, beginning in the 10th chapter, first verse of the book of Deuteronomy. The first thing he did is he gave them his law. Now, the law had apparently been broken and abolished. Moses had broken the two tables of the covenant, and the people had broken their part of it, and there seemed to be no more covenant relationship between this people and God. But now God reestablishes that. At that time the Lord said unto me, hew thee two tables of stone like unto the first, and come up unto me into the mount, and make thee an ark of wood. Now, he was to get two more tables of stone like the first and go back up to the mount like he did in the beginning. But this time he says, to make thee an ark of wood. And I will write on the tables the words that were in the first tables which thou breakest, and thou shalt put them in the ark. So God didn't change the Ten Commandments. There was no need to make any change. He wrote the same words on the second that he did on the first. God doesn't change like that. His law was just as good then as it was a few days before. Wrote the same words. But this time he has this ark now that he made. So in verse 3 he says, "And I made an ark of shittim wood, and hewed two tables of stone like unto the first, and went up into the mount, having the two tables in mine hand." Now let's pause just for a minute here and look at this thing called the ark. We read about the building of this ark in Exodus 25 and 10, and with all the dimensions of it. We also read in Exodus 37, 1, that there was a person named Bezalel, who is probably the actual person who built the ark. Now, it's called the ark here, an ark. It's also called the Ark of the Covenant because it was the box or the container for the tables of stone that had the covenant written on them. It was made of shittim wood. Now, this shittim wood is thought by some to be a wood that's called acacia, A-C-A-C-I-A. And this acacia was abundant in this area of the world, over in the wilderness area. It was a thorn-type tree that was thought to get as large as 2 to 3 feet in diameter. The grain of this wood was close together so that it was a hard wood, a light wood, and very durable, and excellent for the use of making cabinets. A lot of this wood was used in the temple. But this ark, or this casket that was made, this box, was 42 inches long, 27 inches wide, and 27 inches high. And it was overlaid with gold. It had rings on the side of it, and golden staves, or staves covered with, made out of shittim wood, covered with gold, were put through these rings, and that's how it was carried about. It was not to be carried or touched by a man, but they carried it with the staves. And not only was it overlaid with gold, but it also had, as a lid, a thing called the mercy seat. The mercy seat was the place where God actually met with man. This is where God met with the high priest. And the high priest, when he went into the most holy place once a year for the atonement, he sprinkled the blood on the mercy seat and on the area in front of the ark. And then on each end of this ark, they had two cherubs called the cherubim. I believe cherubim is a plural of the word cherub. And they overshadowed the mercy seat. And it's difficult to know much about the cherubim. They're some kind of heavenly being. Whether or not they represent angels, I can't really say. It was thought to be the cherubim that guarded the Garden of Eden when Adam and Eve were cast out of the Garden of Eden. But these cherubim had wings, and we have an account of them being also made to be put in the temple, and it talks about the span of their wings and all. And it's really kind of a difficult thing for me to say just what purpose they did serve, because we don't know that much about them. It's hard to find a description of them. They had some features of several beings, it seems. And it's even thought that the four living creatures, or the four beasts that are mentioned in Revelation 4, also were this type of a being. But it's been suggested by some that these beings then prevented idolatry, because they located on the Ark of the Covenant, which was the very center now of the tabernacle, and later the center of the temple, they then were the only thing that could be created by man and put in there to represent anything. We don't, you know, in the Ten Commandments, he forbids them to make a likeness of anything in heaven or earth, or a graven image. But this seems to be an exception now, to some extent, these cherubim located over the mercy seat. And so the people had a place that was a literal place where God could be said to be. He was at the mercy seat. And this mercy seat indicates a covering. And it's a symbolic of a covering of our sins. And it's a very deep symbol here, because it also goes on into the fact that Christ then is our mercy seat, or our covering for our sins today. But this ark made there, that Moses apparently took up on the mount with him when he brought the two tables of stone for God to rewrite the covenant, it then was going to be the very center of their worship. But when it was a completed work, it had the gold, it had the hoops, it had the staves, it had the mercy seat, and it had the ark. It had the cherubim. And also inside this ark was not only the two tables of stone, but we find that Aaron's rod that budded and the manna from heaven, the pot of manna, was located there. Very prized and precious articles of the faith of this people. And then when the tabernacle was constructed, it was located in the most holy place. And when the temple was constructed, it eventually was brought to the temple. Now, there's a lot of history about the ark. It was taken a lot of places. It was even captured by the Philistines for a while. And finally, David brought it back and was able to put it into the temple. And it seemed to have stayed there until the temple was destroyed by the Babylonians. And then we lose history of the Ark of the Covenant. We do not have a record of it being ever placed back in the temple when the temple was rebuilt. The people lost a very great and precious item of their faith when they lost the ark, and that was lost with the Babylonian captivity. So it's a very interesting thing about this ark, and if we read about it here, it sounds like it's almost just kind of mentioned in passing, but this was the center of the sacred things of the Hebrew people. Now, verse 4, and he wrote on the tables, according to the first writing, the Ten Commandments, which the Lord spake unto you in the mount out of the midst of the fire in the day of the assembly, and the Lord gave them unto me. God wrote the same thing. Now remember, these Ten Commandments, the first four had to do with their service to God, and the last six had to do with their service to man. And so when we love God with all our might and strength and heart, and then we love our neighbor as ourselves, we've really fulfilled the law, because the law has to do with their service to God and their service to man. Only the law spells out how this service was to be done. They were to have no other God before him. They were not to take his name in vain. They were not to have any graven image or likeness of anything in heaven or earth. And they were to keep the Sabbath day holy. And then they were to honor their parents. They were not to kill. They were not to commit adultery, they were not to steal, they were not to lie or bear false witness, and they were not to covet. Those are the Ten Commandments written on there just like the first ten. Now, all of the law then seems to have to do with the ramifications and the explaining of the details that have to do with this keeping of these Ten Commandments, your service to God and your service to man. And so as he gave an expansion of this, he gave all the details about the tabernacle and the temple and the worship and the priesthood and on and on and on. So we have much, much written about it, but it all boils down to really keeping your service to God, your service to man, your duty to God, your duty to man. Ten Commandments. So, and the Lord gave them unto me, and I turned myself and came down from the mount and put the tables in the ark which I had made, and there they be, as the Lord commanded me. Now, even now, as he's talking to this people, nearly 40 years later, he says, there they be. They still were in that Ark of the Covenant. Now, you know, this Ark was not to be touched by man. It was to be carried by the priesthood or by the Levites. And we do have a record one time of where they were bringing the ark back, and they were going across the threshing floor, and it was uneven, and it was about to fall off of the cart. And Uzzah reached up to touch it to steady the ark, and he was struck down dead because he violated God's law. It was not to be touched by man. It was to be carried with the staves, and these staves were to be kept in place at all times. Staves put through those loops. Now, beginning in verse 6, we see another thing God did. We've already studied now about how he gave them his law, verses 1 through 5. Begin with verse 6, we see how he leads them towards Canaan. God is, he's apparently reconciled himself to this people through Moses, and he's going on now with his plan. And the children of Israel took their journey from Beeroth of the children of Jachin to Moriah. There Aaron died, and there he was buried, and Eleazar his son ministered in the priest's office in his stead. And from thence they journeyed unto Gudgoda, and from Gudgoda to Jotbath, a land of rivers of waters. So he's just showing how that God led them on. Aaron died. We discussed that at one time, how he went up on the mount, and it was time for him to be joined with his ancestors. And his son, Eleazar, took his place. So there would be a continuation of this office of priesthood, even though the high priest had to die from time to time. Now, beginning in the 8th verse, we show how that God further blessed them by appointing the Levitical tribe to be special ministers. At that time, the Lord separated the tribe of Levi to bear the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord, to stand before the Lord to minister unto him, and to bless his name unto this day. Now, the tribe of Levi was separated. That part of the tribe of Levi that was the descendants of Aaron, that part of the tribe of Levi were the priests, the Levitical priesthood. Now, not all Levites were priests, but all priests were Levites. And so the other part of the tribe, they had various duties. One part of that tribe, their job was to bear the Ark of the Covenant. Now, they did a lot of traveling. This Ark was ready to move at all times. He tells them how when they take the tabernacle down there to cover this Ark and have the staves there and ready to go. But not just anybody could carry it. The Levites, that was their job. So he tells what they did. They were to bear the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord. They were to stand before the Lord to minister unto him and to bless in his name unto this day. They served as the priests. They ministered. They did various jobs pertaining to the ministry to God and also the ministry to the people. A priest takes the things of man and offers them to God. And as he describes these things here that the Levites did, it reminds me of Ephesians, the 4th chapter, where he's talking about he gave gifts unto men and what the purpose of these gifts were. And he names what the gifts were to do. And so here we have him naming what the Levites did. So he concludes in verse 9, "Wherefore Levi hath no part nor inheritance with his brethren." Levi did not have a tribe. There were some Levitical cities, but he didn't have a tribe. "The Lord is his inheritance, according as the Lord thy God promised him." His inheritance is the Lord. He didn't have a tribe. He didn't have a territory. So when we read about all the 12 territories that the 12 tribes had, Levi didn't have one of those territories. And also, as you know, Joseph didn't have one. But Joseph's two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim, they took the other two tribes to bring it from 10 back up to 12. And we today are the priests of God. We might say that we are the Levites today, except we're more than just Levites. We're all priests. And what is our inheritance? You know, we're strangers in this country. We're really not at home in this world because of the ways of the world. Our inheritance is the same as theirs. What was their inheritance? Their inheritance was God. Our inheritance is God. We have to look forward to God as our inheritance. We're going to inherit the things of God. And so it's interesting to note what he said then about the Levites in that regard. Now then the fourth thing that he does here, beginning in the 10th verse, he gives Moses as their leader and intercessor. "And I stayed in the mount, according to the first time, 40 days and 40 nights, and the Lord hearkened unto me at that time also, and the Lord would not destroy thee." Now, it seems from the reading then that Moses has gone through three periods of fasting, 40 days and 40 nights. First of all, when he received the tables of the covenant the first time. Then whenever he appealed to God not to abolish his people for their sin, that was the second time. And now when he receives the tables of the covenant the second time, he fasts again, which will be the third fast, 40 days and 40 nights. And the Lord would not destroy thee. And the Lord said unto me, Arise, take thy journey before the people, that they may go in and prosper, and possess the land which I swear unto their fathers to give unto them. So Moses now is to lead the people. He's to take his journey before the people. It seems that after this violating of the covenant and after it was broken, that they all had to just kind of start over again. God gave the tables again. They now built this ark of the covenant. Moses had to fast again. Moses was again appointed to be the one to lead them to the land. And just a reorganization, but on the same lines that it was before. And as we know, since Moses is that intercessor, he is a type of Christ. Christ is our intercessor today. He appeals to God on our behalf today. And he appeals to the mercy of God for us. Now, beginning in verse 12, we have a kind of a turn in the chapter. It's still dealing with essentially the same subject. But now that Moses has shown what God did for them, he gave them the law, he let them continue on their journey, he gave them the priesthood, and he gave Moses for the intercessor. Now, he turns to the people, now what are you going to do, Israel? What's your job? What's your part? So verse 12, now Israel, what doth the Lord thy God require of thee? You're to do something too. You know, we know that the keeping of the law didn't save anybody. They couldn't possibly keep the law really like they should have. But that doesn't change the fact that they were to do something. Just like today. We're not saved by our own merits. We don't deserve salvation, but that doesn't change the fact that we're to do something. And so, by the theology that's taught today, these people, after they saw what God had done all this, they could just sit back and fold their arms and say, we got it made. We don't have to do anything. God has done it all for us. All we have to do is just believe. But that's not what he says here. He says, what doth the Lord thy God require of thee, but to fear the Lord thy God, to walk in all his ways, and to love him, and to serve the Lord thy God with all thy heart and with all thy soul. Now, as we finish this chapter, he's going to give several things there to do. And then interspersed with the things there to do, he tells again about the greatness of God, the reason why it's a good thing to do this. But we keep coming back to this idea of keeping the commandments of the Lord, fear him, walk in his ways, love him, and to serve him with all thy heart, with all thy soul. Now that's really, that's the heart of the matter. As Solomon said in Ecclesiastes, what's the sum total of all this? Fear God and keep his commandments. That's the total of it all right there. Fear God and keep his commandments. You can always get down to the bottom line is fear God and keep his commandments. Respect him. Love him. That all goes with the fear we're talking about. Not just a dread of God, but a respect of God. And keep his commandments. That's Ecclesiastes, that's the whole duty of man. Fear God and keep his commandments. So we see that's our duty. Anything that we know that's a command of God, we're to do it. We're to have some, take some note of it. And it's so easy now for us to grow lax. You know, we depend on God a tremendous amount. We should depend on God. We're so weak and we're so frail. We have so many things that do happen to us and we seem to make it through it all right some way or another. We have so many things that could happen and maybe don't happen. We have so many situations that we're really right on the very brink of disaster about if it doesn't just turn the right way. We depend on God for so much. And yet, what about, you know, he says, now Israel, what does the Lord require of thee? We have a part to do in all this. And so what about a person that just skipped church? Just skips. No good reason. They just decide not to come. Maybe not feeling quite right. Now, if they had to go to the job, they sure would go to the job. But not quite right. They're just going to just kind of cut out of church. Just grow a little bit lax. Now, how does God feel whenever you don't carry out your part? Now, we're expecting God to carry out his. Oh, we don't want God to miss anything he's supposed to do for us. But how about us? There's a part for us to play. Somebody says, oh, I'm not feeling too good. You know, I really don't feel very good. Well, you want God to help you get well? You want God to really benefit you? If you feel like serving God, go ahead and serve him. And then God is a whole lot better able to help you because you're doing your end of it. You're doing your part of it. Like a person that says, I sure do need some money to pay the rent. And, well, go to work. And you'll get the money to pay the rent. But just sitting around moping about wishing you had the money for the rent, that's not going to do it. And so it is with us and God. When we see that we have a duty, a clear-cut duty, here's something we can do that's the best thing for us to be doing at the time, and there's nothing else that's really going to prevent us from it. Let's do it. And not look for some little measly excuse. You know, people get sick enough to come to the doctor, but they don't get sick enough to go. They don't go worship God when they're that same sick. You know, there's something not right there. Well, I'd much rather go worship God when I'm sick, if I'm able, than to go to the doctor when I'm sick, if I'm able. See what I'm trying to get at here? We must depend on God. He says, with all thy heart and with all thy soul, to keep the commandments of the Lord and his statutes, which I command thee this day, for thy good. It's not for God's good or anybody else's good. It's for thy good. So the point I want to make here is, and what he's making here also, we must recognize that we have a responsibility. We have an obligation to God. And we expect God to carry out his end of it, which he will do. But we have to carry out our end of it also. Because these people balked at Kadesh Barnea, they didn't get to go into the Canaan land. That's one part of the agreement God didn't feel required to carry out, because they didn't carry out their part of it. They stayed there for 40 years. And so what about us? Whenever we balk, something that we know that we can do, should do, when we balk, what happens? Are we really serving the Lord thy God with all thy heart and all thy soul? Are we really keeping the commandments of the Lord and his statutes, which I command thee this day, for good? Or have we gone a way that God hadn't prescribed?